Welcome to Sandertown United Church. It's great for you all to be here this evening, and what a pleasure it is to welcome Paul and Irene and Wong here to spend some time with us tonight talking about the budget. Or you might not really call it a budget, but like the monster budget that just keeps growing and growing and growing. So I know that these three have, among many of the MPs, have done so much tireless work on our behalf, and we really need to give them our thanks. I know that Wong in particular missed his birthday this year, and I'll explain that, because when the budget debate began, it was Wednesday, and when the budget debate ended, it was Friday. Guess whose birthday was Thursday? So happy birthday. At Sandertown, we've had a series of town halls the past year and a half or so, and we've dealt with issues such as poverty and situation of Aboriginal people in Attawapiskat, and we had Cindy Blackstock here a few weeks ago. And we're really committed to exploring these issues, and tonight is just another step in looking at all the ways that we can make a difference in building the kind of society and country that we believe that we deserve and that all Canadians deserve. So thank you for being here tonight. I'm going to, in a minute, ask Paul to introduce the evening. We're hoping to finish up by about 8:30 because, surprise, surprise, these three have to go back to the House and vote again and again and again. So they'll speak for a few minutes, and then we'll have some time for questions. So again, thank you and welcome.
Thank you all, and really important to acknowledge the community here, and of course, Sandertown United has done a phenomenal job of really being a space and a place so that we can discuss these issues. And I was here for the dialogue on First Nations issues, and you know, we hear about these issues, you know, on the radio and reading them in the newspaper and raise the questions in the House, but fundamentally, these issues need to be brought up in our community. So thank you for hosting us again, because we need to do more of this. We need to be able to connect with each other about what's going on around us. We need to seek each other out, to find common cause, to look at how we can deal with some of these things that are happening in front of us. Because I don't know about you, but there's times where you just feel like there's, you know, too much coming at us. And alone, we can't do it ourselves. And that's the same for members of Parliament. So thank you. You know, a community of faith is a community of faith, and having faith in each other is important. And so well done, and thank you. I'm delighted to have two of my colleagues here with me to share their points of view and their experiences as parliamentarians on a couple of issues that are critical. And I'll start with Wong Mai, who is vice chair of the Finance Committee and our revenue critic, who is one of our new MPs, although you're not new anymore, I don't think, Wong. It's you've gone through a lot in this past year, but has been just an outstanding bright light in our caucus, one of our new members from Quebec, and my good friend Irene Matheson, who has been working on pensions, income security, and of course is from London. I want the two of them to share their perspectives on the budget and what's been happening. I just, my comments, you know, what can I say? I mean, you've read a lot about this thing. It's a massive piece of work. But I want to share with you, and some of you will have heard this, what a member of Parliament said about omnibus bills. And this member said the following. The particular bill before us is an omnibus bill. I put it to you, Mr. Speaker, that you should rule it out of order. It should not be considered by the House in the form in which it has been presented. I would hope that in making your decision on the acceptability of this bill that is present in front of you, that you would actually agree to have it split up. Because where do we stop? Where is the point of no return? I believe that this is a difficult way for members to be able to make decisions and also to be able to represent their constituents. And then further down the comment is the following. For all these reasons I've given, I respectfully submit that this bill is of improper omnibus nature. This is consistent with what I consider and respectfully submit to be the relevant precedents. This is consistent with the traditions of the House and, more important, the purpose of these traditions in terms of the relevance of this House of Commons to the life of the country now and in the future. So this Member of Parliament was urging the government, the Speaker of the day, to have this omnibus legislation split up into different parts so that we could actually have accountability. Of course, the Member of Parliament was when Stephen Harper, and it was in 1994. And I couldn't agree with him more. If there's one thing, and there's so many things in here, 70 pieces of legislation that will be changed, taking away our oversight and environmental assessment, killing Radio Canada International, undermining our archives, OAS changes, on it goes. But the fundamental thing about this document is just what Mr. Harper said years ago. It's not democratic. It undermines our parliamentary democracy. And that's the message we've been getting out to people, is that we can't have a healthy democracy when people abuse the power. This can be done, obviously, but it doesn't mean it should be done. And we have to hold governments to account when they abuse their power in this way. This has resonated. We have former fisheries ministers like Tom Sinnott and Mr. Fraser coming out and damning the approach of the Conservatives. But also, we have former Conservatives who served in the Conservative caucus who are damning this approach. And I think of one, Mr. Mills, who was the critic for the Conservatives from Red Deer, Alberta, and saying, it was wrong to kill the round table on the environment. So we have voices out there that we certainly can turn to say, it's not just us as a party. But this is absolutely fundamental to our democracy. That's why we need to not only oppose what's in this bill, but we also have to oppose the way it's being done. And that's why it's so important to take this message out to all your friends and family and anyone you meet with to say, do you know what's going on in our parliament? Do you know what they're doing with the power that they have? And really get behind this. Before I turn it over to Irene and then to Wong, one last thing that was not in this budget and a very important event that happened today in Parliament Hill, and that is the cuts to refugee health. It is, it undermines not only our core values, but the minister is flat out lying when he says that, here's what the minister says if you haven't heard it, that refugees receive better health care than everyday Canadians, and that we can't tolerate. He actually is saying this. This is how he is pitching this cut. And as I said, this was not in the budget. And so what is the program? It provides refugees with basic health care if they can't afford medicines, if they need to, if they're diabetic and they need supports, or they're asthmatic and they need some medicines. It gives them that support, and they're taking that away. And what they're trying to do, let's be very clear about this, I've seen this show before. They're trying to pit people who are poor against refugees. That's what this is about. It's that simple and that awful. And so today on Parliament Hill and across the country, there were protests against that cut to that program. And we have to stay with that particular issue, of course, because our city and our country is founded on values, shared values, that we actually open up our doors and we share and help those who need help. And let's not let them create this division between people who presently need more help, we can all agree on that, and people who are the most vulnerable are refugees. I was so proud to see the organization of the demos, because it was doctors who just saw this happening, they called each other, it was grassroots, and they're fighting this. And so stay focused on that. Call Mr. Kenny's office and say, it's wrong what you're doing. Reverse the cuts. Tell all your friends and make sure we get that issue pushed. And I'll be sending out stuff on that as well. Now, I've got two of my colleagues here. I want you to hear from them about what this budget is doing in terms of their portfolio, their background, and then I want to turn it over to you to hear from you any questions or comments you have, but I want to hand the mic over to my friend Irene Matheson. Irene.
Thank you very much, Paul. And it's my privilege to be back here at Centretown. I know the dedication of this community to social justice, and thank you so much for taking time out of what is a lovely evening and spending it here with us. I wanted to underscore a couple of things that that Paul said. And first and foremost, the Parliament of Canada is your parliament. It's your place. It shouldn't be distant, and it shouldn't be inaccessible. And what we're seeing over and over again is an absolutely inaccessible and dictatorial kind of entity emerging and shutting Canadians out. It should not. And another thing that it's doing, and I'm very, very concerned about this, is it's undermining our social safety net. And if you stand back from it and look at what we value in terms of supporting community and making sure that there is the kind of systems and supports available to protect people, they're being eroded. The cuts to health, the health transfers, $31 billion when this government brings forward its health care funding formula, and employment insurance, this ever-increasing downward spiral in terms of the support that comes from employment insurance. And it's the money that belongs to the people who work and the employers who contributed to it. It doesn't belong to the government. I mean, bad enough that they stole $57 billion out of the fund. Now they want to see it less and less effective and make sure that fewer and fewer people can access it. And all of this in the name of driving down wages. And it's as simple as that. And finally, the third piece that I want to talk about particularly tonight, and that's old age security. Now, old age security is not a pension. It's a social program. It's there, and it's intended to make sure that people are not in a situation where they're facing absolutely horrible poverty. And we need to protect that. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a sense of history in terms of pensions and seniors and what we want to do as a government. Oh, did that slip out? Because 2015 is coming. Now, first of all, I want you to think back. I've got a little narrative here to when this whole issue of the baby boom generation being a deficit or a millstone around society's neck. There were supposed to be so many boomers. I'm one of them, and there was going to be this huge collapse. First of all, it was supposed to be the CPP, and everyone was very, very concerned, and the government told the population, run out and buy RRSPs. It's the only thing that's going to save you. Well, we know absolutely that CPP is rock solid. We would like to see it reformed to the point where contributions were increased from about, 4.75% of pay to about 7.25% over a 7-year period so that future generations can actually have a doubled CPP benefit. And that would take an awful lot of pressure off people, off budgets. And it's doable. We've looked at it, and it's absolutely doable. So we know CPP is solid. It costs about 4% in terms of management, and it's solid for the next 75 years. So all of that carrying on about RRSPs could have been, I think, to the benefit of not the people of this country or the future seniors, but rather the financial institutions. Because the reality is that they've been the beneficiaries of all of this. Over a 45-year period, about 40% of what you put into an RRSP is gobbled up in management fees. And for those folks who find before they retire, they're close to retirement, they might need a new roof and they want to cash in an RRSP, the penalties are horrendous. And as one senior who came into my office said, any benefit I got from income tax has been absolutely eradicated by what's happened to me now. Now, the next sort of piece of concern or issue that arose was the fact that people suddenly realized that only about 30% of Canadians are covered by an employment pension plan. That means 70% of us don't have that employment pension plan. And those who do, like Nortel employees, aren't necessarily protected. With Nortel, they had a reduction of 40% in their retirement benefit after having saved all of their lives, faithfully put their money into a pension plan, giving up wage increases so they could have a secure pension. They were told, sorry, company's gone bankrupt, too bad. And, oh, you people on disabilities? Nope, there's not going to be any disability pension for you. Now, the United States, they had Nortel employees. The UK, they had Nortel employees. And when Nortel sold off some of its intellectual profit to the tune of billions of dollars, the UK and the United States made sure that their pensioners were protected. Canada did not. We could have. There is still about $7 billion in that fund. But the government of Canada, this Harper government, said, no, we can't be bothered. Too bad. So sad. And so those Nortel folks are still twisting in the wind. And that could very well happen to a whole group of people over and above that 70% who don't have a pension plan. So we knew that we had some changes to make, and that was the whole point of the provinces and the NDP and the labor movement calling on this government for pension reform. And the CPP reform was part of it. And we also told this government that for about $800 million, they could increase GIS to seniors and lift every senior out of poverty. And they said, well, no, we can't possibly do that. I mean, they had $72.5 billion for big oil, for the banks, for profitable corporations, multinationals, but they didn't have $800 million for our seniors. At any rate, they did meet with the provinces, and nine provinces were very interested in pension reform. Only one was not, Alberta. And the response to that by the federal government was, well, if we can't have all of you, then we'll have none of it, and we're going to forget all about pension reform. And we'll give $300 million to GIS, which is less than half of what was needed, and that'll be the end of it, except we have this brilliant new scheme. You've heard of RRSPs. You've heard of snake oil. We have pooled registered pension plans for you. And the problem with the pooled registered pension plan is, well, the employer initiates it, goes to the financial institutions that set it up, but it's not indexed, it's not guaranteed, the management fees are quite significant, the transferability of it is still questionable, and it's just another glorified group, RRSPs, where somebody's going to get skinned and somebody's going to make a lot of money, and it's not going to be the financial institutions that get skinned. So we've got all of that going, and then our dear Prime Minister goes to Davos, where he makes the pronouncement that not only are things difficult and he has to make cuts and we have to get rid of all kinds of civil servants that provide services, but we have to get that bunch, that next generation of those awful seniors. Now, this generation, they're going to be all right. But beginning in 2023, there's going to have to be changes made to old age security because it's not sustainable. Now, if you take the raw numbers, right now it costs about $33 billion to support OAS, and in 2030, when we have 9.8 million seniors. Right now we have about 4.8, 9.8 million seniors. It will cost about $108 billion, which sounds like a lot. It sounds overwhelming. But when you start to look at the real numbers, the numbers that the actuarial folks of OAS provided, that the Parliamentary Budget Officer provided, that the OECD provided, OAS is absolutely sustainable. In the early 90s, it cost about almost 3% of gross domestic product to look after seniors, the OAS part of it. Right now, it's about 2.3% of gross domestic product. So it's gone down. By 2030, it'll go back up to about 3.3. And then after that, because boomers will begin to die off, it'll go back down to 2.3. And over the next several decades after that, right down to 1.4% of GDP. In other words, we can afford to look after our seniors, who are not a drag on our economy. They are an asset. They are our grandparents. They built this country. They made Medicare. They provided the infrastructure. And they take all of that money that they have at their disposal, and they spend it right in our neighborhoods. They invest in small businesses going to those small businesses, and they create employment, and they create stability. So our government lied to us once again. OAS is absolutely sustainable. And in fact, the government had actuarial figures in 2007. They asked for them from the chief actuary. And those figures showed absolutely that OAS was sustainable. Now, it's interesting, that report that was commissioned, it was about 159 pages long, and then it disappeared into the ether. The National Post asked for the report, and first of all, they denied that there was a report, and then they grudgingly found it somewhere. Unfortunately, when the Post got a hold of it, it was all redacted. It was all blacked out for except for about a page and a half. So they're hiding something, and they're hiding it from us. And they're misleading Canadians, and they're trying to undermine what is absolutely essential to all of us, and that is our social safety net. Now, I'm going to pass the microphone over to Wong very, very shortly, but I want to tell you what I've been up to, and I'll tell you the truth. I have been talking to seniors and seniors' orgs and asking them, what do we need to do? Because, I mean, the truth is, in the next 25 years, there's going to be a doubling of the number of seniors in our country. We have to prepare for them. We have to plan for them. We have to be ready. Because ready or not, they're going to be there. And we can do that by being intelligent and by being practical. First and foremost, we maintain the age of retirement at age 65, because to do otherwise is to download the cost of those 2 years between 65 and 67 onto the provinces, and to deprive seniors of that support that they've earned. Secondly, we have to look at our healthcare system. Seniors worry about their healthcare system, and we can make it efficient, and we can make it affordable, and we can make it do its job by bringing long-term care, home care, and pharmacare under the auspices of the Canada Health Act. If we do that, we can make life a lot more affordable, because if a senior goes into hospital, the cost of care for that one day in hospital is equal to about 12 home care visits. We need a standard across the country in terms of long-term care. And you've heard the horror stories about seniors who have been abused and neglected in the for-profit sector. So we have to have rules that are consistent and that look after seniors. And in terms of pharmacare, if we have bulk buying, if we eliminate this nonsense about evergreening pharmaceuticals forever, we can save $11 billion a year. And we can make life more affordable, and we can improve the quality of life all the way around. We need to look at seniors' needs for activities. I'd like to see hubs in every community where seniors can go for socializing and advice and foot care and whatever else they need from their community so that they can live comfortably and live in dignity and have the good health that will make all of our lives better. And basically, I want there to be respect for seniors. I want there to be a national housing program so that housing is affordable. I want those services and the transportation to be there so that, that life has quality, that the seniors of this country have built in the past, continue to build, and will build in the future. And we can do it. It's affordable. It's intelligent. And unfortunately, it's not what we're hearing from this current government. And I, in the fall, hope to take this across the country and talk to more and more people about what we can do, what we must do as a caring and loving society, because that is why we're here. We're here to look after each other. Now I'm going to pass the mic over to Wong, and I want to tell you, I know you missed your birthday. I make a point of missing birthdays all the time, so I don't feel sorry for you at all, but I know you've got really wonderful things to tell folks. So.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for being here. It's so important, and thank you, Paul, and everyone for organizing it. Yes, I did miss my birthday, but it's something that I'll remember for a long time, spending 22 hours in the House of Commons and voting. So that's something that's going to be very special for me. And also, it's more what we were doing. We were basically standing up, really fighting for what we believed in. And so that's why at the end, for us from the inside, like for the MPs, even though none of the amendments were accepted, we felt like we won. We felt like something. We did something. We brought the attention to a massive bill to Canadians, and I've been working on it too. On the weekend, I didn't have time to sleep much because Saturday we had a town hall meeting in my riding, and on Sunday I went to Saskatchewan and Regina to talk about the bill and to meet with people. But I mean, this is so important. And that's why I think that's where we get the energies, because we think that's we need to get people to understand and to know what this bill is all about. And to be quite frank, even though I'm on the finance committee, and we had to look that's the committee that had to look at the whole bill. There was a subcommittee that actually looked at the environmental part, which was one third of the bill. But we had to look at all the other clauses. We had to vote on them. So before voting, we had to understand really what the consequences were. So we actually met with witnesses. We had a lot of people come in. So spent a lot of time on that issue. And one thing I sort of realized was it's first of all, there's the lack of transparency. The fact that the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, clearly told us, he was one of the first witnesses who came and said, well, it's unacceptable, the lack of transparency. He cannot understand how parliamentarians can actually vote on this because there's so much information that is missing, and intentionally missing. A lot of information was kept. We talked about OAS, for instance. They knew the numbers, but they didn't want to tell us. And at the end, they told us, okay, they're going to save $1.8 billion, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not something that... So, and those are some of the... and that's why right now, even today, the PBO has said that legally, I mean, the government has is going against its own law, that they should be more transparent. So that's one of the things that I sort of realized in the Finance Committee, where we had to make decisions, but we sort of just realized the information that we were given to us even was not complete. So it was very difficult for us to really grasp the whole extent of the bill, but we sort of understand also that it can be harder for Canadians to really understand the whole thing, but that's why we are here, and that's why we're trying to share information. We're also learning, and that's why we're here today, to hear from you also, because you know, even a lot of the questions that were asked, some of them I couldn't answer, and then I went back and got more information. So I think it's a whole process. I think it will take a bit of time for everyone to understand, even for journalists. I mean, the media has been scratching its head and trying to understand really the extent of the bill. If I look at on the national revenue, so I won't say I don't understand, because that's my portfolio, so I might get fired if I do that. But yeah, there's a section regarding charitable organizations, and you probably heard about it. We saw the Minister of Environment going out and actually attacking directly charitable organizations, especially environmental organizations, saying that they were radicals, and then saying that they were laundering money. We then have the Prime Minister basically saying, you know, if you don't agree with us, we'll cut your funds. So, and I've been meeting with a lot of organizations, charities, and there are concerns. There is a big concern in terms of how CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, will be looking at the political activities. Just so that you understand, basically the rules has not really changed in the sense that charities can still do political activities if it's within a 10% rule. I won't go too much into the details, but those rules haven't changed. What has changed is the government has given more power and more money to CRA to look after the charitable organizations that are doing political activities. And when we understand that the government really doesn't like people who are, you know, saying what you're doing is bad, so there is a bit of concern. So my advice when I met with the organizations is just basically follow the rules. There'll be some more information coming up from CRA in terms of the forms that will have to be filled out. So on that sense, it's not too much of a worry, but the thing that we have to be worried about is how the government is actually, you know, shutting down and telling people not to say anything that is against our policies. So that's the main concern for us. And you know, I can't not say a word about the environment, because even though it's not my portfolio, I mean, everything about this bill is about you know, promoting pipeline, getting the environment assessment. We look at the Fishery Act, fish habitat. Basically, that really affects our water, and that's something that we have to be concerned about. That if you look at what's happening in Alberta with the oil spills from the you know, pipeline, then they say, well, you know, it's not a problem. We'll have them auto-regulate, and we don't need to look at that. And that's what is really the concern. And when I was saying, you know, we might just understand how far they've gone in just a couple of years, that's when we'll see all the impact of that on the environment and the rest. I mean, I as I said, I don't want to go too much into the environment, because we could be here for a long time. There's another big part of the bill that deals with well, actually it's not big, it's just a couple of provisions, but it has a huge effect on Canada and the immigration. Paul has mentioned for healthcare for refugees, but also you know, there's 280,000 people waiting to come to Canada for so many years in terms of foreign skilled workers, and they just decide to do a delete, tell people, well, you know, you might be a doctor, you might be an engineer, you might be an architect, but right now that's not what we need. So we'll even though you've followed the rules, you've been patient, you've waited for us, you made sacrifices, you might have started learning the language or the languages, but you'll have to reapply. And one of the things we're seeing is they're sort of pushing towards temporary foreign workers. So basically, people who come here, who work on pipelines or work on some of the oil sand fields. You know, the word says it, temporary foreign workers. So they all could just come here. So there's no intention of really having them come and be part of, you know, I come from a family of immigrants. I was lucky to be born here, but my parents are from Vietnam, and I know that Paul and his mother did a lot. But, I mean, that's not the country that we actually want in terms of vision, in terms of where we see in the long term. And everything that's happening and everything that we don't like about, it's here in this bill. So that's why for us it's been so important fighting, getting out there. And as I said, these are only a few things. If I don't have time to go through everything that there's in the bill, but there's so many things. And first of all, thank you again for coming out, for listening, for getting involved. Hopefully you'll learn a few things here and there, and hopefully maybe you'll talk about it. And as I said, I've seen in my own writing, people are, even though I'm from Quebec, so there's a lot of talk about the social crisis. So the budget comes a bit after, but still, it's so huge in terms of what's happening to our country. And we feel we've been doing a pretty good job in terms of trying to show that there's something wrong and trying to get the message out. But we definitely need your help in terms of spreading the word. So thank you very much.
If you would like to have some questions, to come forward. We'll ask you to come forward and speak at the mic. Keep the question to about 20 seconds. And if possible, we're going to take three questions at a time. So you guys are going to have to listen really well. But I just wanted to say about the charitables, when you're talking about charitables, that the United Church was one of the churches that was attacked by Senator Eaton in the news in the last week or so. And Marty Tyndall, the moderator of the United Church of Canada, has written a really fine response, and it's online. I'd urge you to take a look at that and the role of faith communities in the political process. But if anybody asks you what you were doing here tonight, just say bingo. So come on up.
Hi. First of all, thank you for your devotion, your passion, your tenacity to see this through. I noticed in the pews, voices united. So maybe that's what we all are about, is we are voices united. And as each of you were talking, I wondered, you know how superheroes wear their street clothes and then they go into the phone booth and they rip off their clothes and then they got their superhero costume on? I wondered if you have pajamas underneath your suits. And then I thought, what would happen if you go in to the house wearing orange pajamas, green pajamas, red pajamas, and say, we will be here as long as it takes to break this apart? I don't really have any questions other than I'm just devastated by what's happening to the refugees. I'm devastated to what's happening to the immigrants, to our country. I'm going to Guatemala in a couple of weeks, a country like so many countries that is under so-called democracy, but it's really an autocratic military kind of a regime. And I'm going there with my heart breaking because I see our country is our democracy is slipping away. I was on the Hill the other night when you guys were up overnight. And yeah, we were a rally, but we were a small rally. We've got to fill the Hill. And it seems like groups come together across the country. Groups come together for our, town halls. But we need to be bigger and louder and really sustain our energy the way you people are. So I just, no questions, I just want to thank you very much for your tenacity.
Sure, yeah, my name's Chris. I actually work at the Center 507, which is right here. It's a drop-in center and soup kitchen that's connected to this building, for those of you who don't know. And so I'm a social worker, and I do have a lot of clients who are on ODSP, disability, and they're getting up in their years, so I was wondering about the specifics of OAS, just because I haven't had any time to read through. So the specifics as to what's going on with OAS as well as EI. That'd be great.
Hello, my name is Raj. What I want to talk about is the constant contempt that not the government of Harper, but the dictatorship of Harper has shown. First of all, he has killed responsible government the way he runs the country through the PMO, even his own ministers are not responsible for their departments. We've seen that with Bevoda, and we see time and time again. That is not a budget. That is not even a manifesto. That is a Harper thumbing his nose at us and showing even more contempt. What I want to remind you guys here today is that you guys are now Her Majesty's loyal opposition. And that loyalty is owed to us, the people, not to Harper. So what I wanted you to go back and say to your colleagues, including the Liberals, is do not give Harper legitimacy. After this fight, walk out of the House and don't go back until there's another budget. Let's be inspired by the revolutions that are happening outside of these places that are not supposed to have democracy, that are reminding us that we used to have a democracy. Come back to the people, go on Parliament Hill, go out to the communities like you're doing right now, and rally the people, like the First Lady said. Remind the people, the electorate, that there was more people out here who didn't vote than did vote for Harper. So all I'm asking you, will you go back and ask your colleagues to walk out of the House?
For the question, it's a very good one. And in regard to ODSP or Ontario Works or any provincial social program, the problem is that the government did not consult with the provinces. Harper went to Davos and he said the age of retirement will increase from 65 to 67, and there was no discussion. And it creates a tremendous problem. First of all, private pensions are set up based on age 65, and provincial benefits are based on age 65. So you've got someone who is surviving on ODSP or Ontario Works, and we know that it's not enough. We know that it's a desperately inadequate support system, and they've been waiting until age 65 when they can have that better and more secure income. Now that's been taken away. And the problem, when there's a number of problems, is that for a lot of these folks, they can't make it beyond age 65. And for the working poor, they can't make it beyond age 65. There's a study that's come out that indicates that people who are at lower incomes or who have done very difficult, hard labor all their lives live 6 years less than people who had higher incomes. So basically what we're saying to these folks is their retirement years are going to be more difficult, and that ease or that golden time that we keep talking about is going to be less and less. And the downloading to the provinces is going to be extremely difficult. We keep hearing about all kinds of downloading. We've seen downloading of post-secondary education onto the backs of students, and we've seen downloading of unemployment onto the backs of those who are unemployed, and now we're seeing downloading onto the provinces. And it's going to be very, very difficult. The provinces are very unhappy, and they're also very unhappy with the new employment insurance rules, particularly when it comes to seasonal workers, those folks who are in the forests or in the fisheries or in agriculture. They're being told now that they're going to have to take less and less. They're going to have to travel up to an hour and a half to find work. And for a lot of communities, it is extremely difficult to make that kind of transition. We heard some years ago from maritime communities that had been hollowed out. Women left behind with kids because their partners had to go to the oil sands or go somewhere else to try to earn a living. And the destabilization of those, in many cases, very old communities, and by old I mean they've been there generation upon generation. So we're seeing a whole change in our landscape and an undermining of what, as I said earlier, is our social safety net. And it's interesting, when the Harperites Harpies or whoever they are get up in the House, they say, well, everybody has to make this adjustment. Europe is making this adjustment, and they're increasing the age of retirement. Yeah, from 60 to 62. Or from 62 to 65 if they're really, really in trouble. Only the Americans are going from 65 to 67, and we're following in tandem. I'll let Paul and Huang answer the really hard questions.
Well, maybe just quickly regarding employment insurance, and Irene has touched pretty much on it. It does affect a lot of industries. We've seen a lot of people from actually the province of Quebec, they were against, the National Assembly has voted unanimously against what is in the new EI rules. And also we've seen it with the Atlantic provinces. So there is an attack on the seasonal workers, on certain industries. Irene mentioned fisheries, agriculture, tourism, all those, you know, because basically what's happening with the new rules is they're saying, well, take this job, which could be close to 30% less in terms of what you're earning. If you're not taking the job, then you won't be able to benefit from EI. And we mentioned that it can be an hour drive from where you live, so an hour in the morning, an hour coming back. In rural riding can be really far. So that is a problem. And also when you look at everything that people, you know, I've had actually in my town hall, someone came up with the example. She was working for, I think, 35 years as a secretary, and she gained all this experience. So, but they told her, well, go get another job, a permanent job, or else you won't benefit from EI. And if you come back and you ask for EI, then the next job that you're taking, can go, the salary goes down to 70% of what you're earning. But if you look at, if you compare to what you were earning, if you look at different jobs, you're trying to make ends meet, and you're taking, you know, part-time work, how will they calculate which job you were, what you were getting? So there's a lot of issues. We had to force the minister to give us more information in terms of what was, I'm not sure about the translation, mais en français, it's a convenable, so convenient, or, yeah, so suitable, that's the term. So what would be suitable? So the minister came out and said, well, you know, gave us some idea, but there's still a lot of question. But the main thing was that none of the provinces were really, you know, consulted, and a lot of the problems that will come, and if we're talking about people with disabilities, often it's the provinces that have to handle all of that. So a lot of issues, not a lot of answers. Again, the type of thing that we'll see as we go along.
Before going to the next questions, address a couple of the issues around what we're dealing with here and how to deal with it. You know, the idea of not going back into Parliament has been brought up by others, and just saying until you guys are going to reestablish, and you're absolutely right, Raj, this is about responsible government. You know, the whole idea of responsible government is that you elect people to represent you, and that you respect the powers which have been conveyed upon you. And right now we're seeing, as was mentioned, concentration of power in the Prime Minister's office. And we now have a Chief of Staff involved in, you know, primary negotiations on trade deals. So if you're the Minister of International Trade, you kind of wonder what your job is, I guess. But it is. It's fundamental here. And yes, we've seen this go on for a number of years, concentration of power in the PMO, but this is unprecedented. I think at this point, we're wanting to make sure that we don't, you know, we give as much focus as we can on both Parliament and in communities, and that's why my colleague's been traveling across the country. I did it for a while too, but for some, you know, a related kind of task. But no, that's what we're going to do, to connect with people, to say, this is your Parliament, this is what's happening, and we need to get together with voices united, I love that, and bring forward the, you know, our critique to government. And also, and you've heard this from my colleagues, and I'll be doing the same, what we want to see. And that's absolutely critical, because you can just collapse from the weight of despair, and we have to find the hope, and we'll find it in each other. And the other piece is just looking at what has been happening, and you look at what's happening around the world, and you say, you know, is this the way we want to see our country go in the direction? And, you know, when we see things happening elsewhere, and we're positive in terms of that change, and then we see things being undermined at home, we have to pay attention to both and say, you know, if we're going to be a model for the rest of the world, we can't be, you know, hypocrites at home. And I mean, it's, when we're talking about the rule of law, as this government loves to talk about, when it's critiquing other countries, and then you turn around and see what it's doing here, where what Wang Mai was explaining earlier is very important. The parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, who, by the way, whose position was created by legislation by this government, has said, I am not getting the information I've requested that is the resolve of and the responsibility of government to give to me. And they're not doing it. They're breaking the rules. They're breaking the law. They're not following the law. And we've seen this time and time again with this government. So this isn't about an interested partisan. This is the parliamentary budget officer. And that's the extent it's come to. So we need to keep the focus on parliament. We need to do our job in parliament. I'm not sure at the point where I'm ready to walk out and not return, but I've heard that from others, so you're not alone. But we need to keep the pressure on in communities and connecting with people, as well as in parliament. But that's where people, that's how frustrated people are. And Raj, you're among them, saying, why bother? Because they're abusing their power to the extent they are.